What alliances will we build in Europe? Well, I think we already have a pretty strong alliance. As I mentioned during my speech, 48 members of the European Parliament are in the Green Party. We also sit in a group with another 10 members added on to that, so it comes to a total of 58. Personally, I've been very active with the Young Greens as well, and actually I've got friends who are going to be standing in different places as candidates, some of them who are likely to actually end up as MEPs, and they're good friends of mine. So if it's Terry Rinke in Germany, Jeroni Verger in the Netherlands, or Guillermo Rodriguez in Spain, friends of mine who are going to be MEPs. And I think that's the sense of what we have as a party. The Greens are a big family in Europe, and we're working really closely, as I mentioned as well. We've put together a common EU manifesto. So you know when you vote for the Greens here in Northern Ireland, you're going to get common policies right across the EU. We're not going to have to go into a negotiation position. And I think that reflects as well that we have elected representatives all over the world as Green Party. So.
Right. Ross, we know you're going to be with the Green Party. Anyway, what other parties do you think you can cooperate with?
Well, I think that, I mean, as I mentioned at the as well, I mean, we haven't been happy with the direction that Europe has taken. It has gone down the route. Europe's currently controlled by parties who would be traditionally parties of the right wing. I mean, we have got the Parliament at the moment is balanced to the right wing, and then we also have the majority of EU nation state governments are governments to the right as well. So that isn't the politics that we're coming from. If people aren't happy with the direction Europe has taken, well, that's who they ought to consider blaming for those issues.
All right, moving on swiftly. Does the panel believe that there should be free flow of population within the EU states? Why not have local jobs for local people? Martina Anderson.
Well, I say for anyone who is sitting here this evening and for many, many others who are at home, who have a son or a daughter leaving these shores to go to Australia or America or anywhere else, that they would hope that those who would be involved and in charge of making legislation and rules would not do so in a way that was going to prevent their child from accessing employment. What we need to ensure, I think, for people here, so that we don't have a brain drain, is that we get social clauses in procurement contracts. And that was something that I had argued very clearly for when I was an MLA here. And it is one of the commitments that we have in the programme for government. So, for instance, Ciaran Killen, when we see the stadiums being built, we have social clauses in procurement contracts so that those people from the long-term unemployed can get access to a potential job that they would not have otherwise received. I do not believe that we should have a situation where those who are not from the North or from Ireland should in any way be prevented from getting a job here in Ireland. I think that what people bring who come to Ireland to work and to live is that diversity that we should all embrace.
Thank you. Gavin Robinson.
Thank you, Chairman. And I think it's a terribly interesting question given the news that we've had this week, particularly in East Belfast, with a poster campaign which is criticising the access to jobs within the shipyard in particular. There's an oil rig in the shipyard, for those of you who don't know, at the moment. There are about 650 people working on the reconfiguration, the fitting out of that oil rig, and about 100 of those individuals are local. So the poster campaign, I think, plays to some of the deeply negative stereotypes that we have of racism within our society. The facts are that if people in Northern Ireland are able to do the job, have the skills to do the job, are prepared to do the job, then they should have an equal and unfettered access to apply to do that job, in my opinion. I have an issue with the European Union when it comes to unfettered immigration at large. Whilst I, as an individual, and all of you as an individual, have the opportunity to travel right throughout the European Union for holidays and recreational purposes, I do think that we need to have, as a member state, as a national country, the ability to say that unless you're adding something, unless we have a deficit which you can fill, it may not be the right place for you to come. Similarly, if I were to go to another member state, unless I had skills that were useful to that economy at that time, which they couldn't satisfy themselves, then I would expect them to tell me, come and visit. You're more than welcome to visit. In fact, we benefit from engaging on that basis. But I would expect them to tell me that we have no requirement for your skills and we can satisfy the need we have locally. I have to say that social clauses as a concept are a great idea. They started with some of the involvement that we had in Belfast City Council in the construction of the Titanic building, the Titanic Signature Project. A contractor from Croatia was able to satisfy the social clauses we had here in Belfast in Northern Ireland through apprenticeships in their country. So even though we had a social clause, even though that was to benefit our Indigenous people, it was to create apprenticeships that were to give young people in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, an opportunity where otherwise there may not have been one. The conditions Gavin, were satisfied outside of this country, outside of our economy, and outside of the young people who needed the opportunity, and the purpose of the social clause was to give them that opportunity.
Just that one of the foundation principles, again, is the free movement of goods and workers and services. Now, I'm not quite clear. Are you saying that there should be some further restriction on that because of the expansion within the EU? And if you are, just so I fully understand your position there.
Yeah, well, I think that there have been national agreements about those countries that most recently acceded within the European Union and some of the protections that are there. So if it's a movement of skill and it's a skill that needs to be satisfied, then I think that is a good thing. And I referred to that earlier as a good thing. If there is not a skill or a service that there is a requirement for, then I think questions have to be asked. Because
and would you apply that so-called mutatis mutandis? Would you apply it in the same way if people from the UK and Ireland were in fact trying to move into other European countries if they didn't have a job? Because is that not going to be a potential problem if we say, well, we're only going to allow you to come in if you've got a skill or a service, but you may be looking for experience. Do we then impose upon ourselves a certain restraint on our own young people?
Well, this is an issue that you have when you have 27, 28 member states, all of whom have a commonality, but none of whom have the ability to control borders, none of whom have an ability to set their own destiny, to chart their own course. There's nothing that I wish to, what I'm saying, to sound as if I'm being discriminatory. I think there are huge benefits in the ability for me, if I have a skill or a skill set that's required in France, for example, to move to France and to work within that field. Similarly, for a French person, a German person, a Spanish person, a Greek person to come to Northern Ireland, should we require and benefit from the contribution that they can make? But I think unless we frame the discussion in that way, then there are issues, there are problems, and unfortunately, I think it fuels some of the issues that we've seen appear in the posters in East Belfast, because actually the content of those posters, if you've seen them, most of it's nonsense.
Yeah.
Most of it plays on fears. Most of it plays on racism. Most of it is raising an issue that ordinarily, and from a societal perspective, isn't an issue and doesn't need to be an issue. And actually, when we consider it in the terms of loyalist working class education underachievement, I think if we perpetuate the view, the myth, that it's okay to blame everybody else because I don't have a job, we do nothing to help those individuals who need an aspirational rise, and we need to create the opportunities for
them. Thanks, Gavin. Sovereign governments in the EU have had to implement public expenditure cuts of some 25% to try and make the books balance. How would the parties reduce the cost of administering Europe? Alex Atwood.
To prove your point of an earlier comment, can I just deal with this the last question?
Yes, of course.
The issue is not free movement of workers, which I support. The issue is creating jobs in our domestic economies. That's what the issue is. And if we deal with what people think the symptom of the problem is, namely that there's people coming and taking our jobs, then we miss the point. And the point is that we have to create more jobs. The biggest European research and development fund, and was touched upon earlier, is known as FP7. It's just concludes this year. It's 50 billion euro. And the drawdown by the Irish government of FP7 R&D monies over the 6 years up to 2014 was close to 900 million euro. The drawdown of the Northern Ireland government is going to be less than £50 million. What does that tell us? It is that we are not punching to our weight in Europe to draw down the R&D and innovation monies that could be spread across our small, medium, university and FE colleges, and not create the jobs, high-value, skilled jobs, that would sustain our economy and our people, avoid immigration. And then, not only could immigrants get jobs, then there'd be jobs for many more. That's the point. And touching upon another earlier question, if the SDLP was in the European Parliament, come to July of this year, the biggest group in the European Parliament, representing up to 30% of its membership, over 200 people, would be the group that the SDLP is a member of, being able to access influence in the corridors of power, the commissioners, and the institutions.
How would you balance the books, Alex?
So let's deal with, I'll deal with the balance of the books.
I know that, but
Europe and many others got it wrong, that they went headlong in to the strategy of austerity when, as we've seen in more recent times, the issue was to have a strategy for growth as the same time you tried to cut out waste, tried to reduce bureaucracy. And that's what you have to do.
As coherent as that answer is, it does answer every question I've asked in the last round. So can I ask you briefly, how would you balance the books?
Sorry, what do you mean by balancing the books?
Well, you've got to, according to governments, this is a question that you've got to implement public expenditure cuts close to 25%. Do we reduce European expenditure in terms of the cost of administering Europe? How do we do that?
If you can find good ways to reduce the cost of bureaucracy in Europe, let's take it forward. Yeah. But what you don't do is just have a slash and burn strategy. What you have to have is a strategy that identifies savings, yes, that doesn't go down the road of austerity, and at the same time has a growth opportunity. I'll give you an example on this island. And whatever about happens in Europe, there's opportunities on this island. 40% of all monies on the island of Ireland are spent on health. 40%. Close to 50% of the budget of the Northern Ireland Executive is spent on health. Yet, when it comes to all Ireland procurement of medical services and facilities, when it comes to integration of all Ireland health opportunities, there's virtually nothing being done.
Right.
So you asked me the question about balancing the books.
Yeah,
you can balance the books by integrating services, not just within Europe, but also on the island of Ireland.
Thank you, Alex. Reg MP.
Well, the first thing it's important for us in the United Kingdom to do is not be in the euro. We must retain our membership of the sterling area. The reason why Greece and other countries got into trouble was because they were shoehorned into the euro at a time when they weren't fit to be in the euro. And you had one interest rate serving countries as diverse as Greece and Germany. It suited Germany so it could pay for its recapitalisation of its industry at low rates of interest, which it did extremely well. And we saw what happened in the Republic, where it should have had a higher interest rate. Instead, money was sloshing around. It was all put into property, and the whole thing went bust. And Portugal and Spain ended up in huge difficulty. That was because politics overruled the economic necessities. So you asked how you balance the books. The first thing you do is don't get into spending areas until you have a reasonable prospect of having the money. Everything should be directed to creating wealth, that is, upskilling our young people. And unfortunately, now people might want to shy away from this, but uncontrolled immigration is just not long-term feasible. I see it in London every day. The place is full up. And you can't just absorb huge amounts of people who come there for obvious reasons. I mentioned 83 pence as a living wage. If you were in Romania or Bulgaria on 83 pence, wouldn't you want to come here or a country like here? So I'm not against movement, but it has to be under control. And as far as the budget is concerned, the reason we are in those countries are in the mess that they're in because politics got carried away and it overruled the economic realities of life.
Thank you. Now, we have a number of other questions here, some put forward by CARE. The European Union talks about religious freedom, Article 9, Article 14 of the European Convention. Do you believe it is important, and how would you promote it, especially with regard to the moral norms in Northern Ireland? Complicated question, but essentially European Union is putting religious freedom right at the heart of the European Convention. Do you believe that's important, and how would you promote it, especially with regard to Northern Ireland? Anna Lowe.
Thank you. That's a difficult question to ask an atheist. No, I would be very much in favour of religious freedom. It is important, the same as I think freedom of movement, freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, all the human rights issues. That's, I think, freedom for religion is enshrined in the Convention for Human Rights. And I think, you know, in terms of, I want to maybe go back to some of the previous answers, questions. I think the freedom of movement is important. Europe is a massive common market. We need to certainly to make the best out of that massive common market of 500 million people. The freedom of movement, freedom to trade is very, very important. And it is a two-way process. Our young people can go to Europe and see, you know, lots of open doors, open opportunities for them. So, I mean, no one is an island now. This is a globalised world. And, you know, it's at your own peril if you stay closed door and close in.
I'm getting very lax, Anna, because we're again straying back into the retrospective. So again, maybe Tina McKenzie, can I maybe ask you the question about religious freedom? Sorry.
Sure, and I was really looking forward to answering the one on the labour market, because that's obviously my area of expertise. But I'd certainly answer that. I mean, definitely, we've got some problems here in Northern Ireland, which tells us what happens when you put people into government who want to put their religion before their nation. So we've got the perfect example here in Northern Ireland where we're
Do you think you should put your religion before your nation?
I think what's
call
it what you like. Some people may say they're an atheist. Some people may say they're a Roman Catholic. Some people may say, as tonight in this lovely Presbyterian church, what's more important than any religion is how anybody works, their own internal integrity, and they may give that a label, a religion or whatever. Now, the good news about Europe is that actually our behaviours are more important than the label we put on ourselves. So in Europe today, they spend 50% of the world's social expenditure, which means that behaviour in Europe is actually about looking after their people. Social expenditure in terms of their public sectors, in terms of their health services, they're actually doing a better job than we are, I must say. And if I may be so bold to say, let's get to the facts. When you go to London, I'm lucky, I'm a Northern Irish Belfast girl. I lived in London for 7 years. Most of those people you see are actually Londoners. They're not, you know, London isn't full of people that have been shipped in. It is a cosmopolitan city, has been for a long time. And if I may finish, between 2010 and 2012 in Northern Ireland, 12,900 people came here, 12,500 left here, 400 people. I sat at the heart of Europe working with big companies and small companies, and when they look around the world to decide where to put their business, they look at nations that are open, flexible, pluralist. They don't want to go to places where their executives may not fit in. They want to go to open places. They want to hire the local labour force. But equally, if there aren't skills there, they want to know they can bring them in. Our problem is that we're not creating the jobs ourselves here because we lack leadership. We lack proper government.
Okay, Martina Anderson, sorry.
Well, I think the European Convention of Human Rights affords us a lot of protections, and obviously religious protection is one of those. What I would want to do, and what I do, is to continue with what I advocate in Europe, and that's about promoting respect and tolerance for each other's religion, regardless of what tradition we come from. And I think that is crucially important. My father was a Protestant, Church of Ireland, and converted to Catholicism. My mother was a Catholic, and there was never an issue in our household about one's religion. It's about respecting each other's religion. And I think in the North, where we are at the moment, that is the direction of travel for all of us now as MEPs, and that is what we have to do in the future.
Okay, thanks. Now, Henry Reilly, you mentioned in your talk that clearly you'd be very in favour of reform, almost complete reform. I'm not sure if I entirely understand that. Some panel members have spoken of reforming the EU. Can you be specific about what changes you would work for? Is it completely getting out of the EU, or is there a via media? Is there some other halfway house?
Chairman, the European Union is irreformable. It's impossible to reform. Yeah. It would, regardless of what cast iron Dave Cameron tells us, do you remember the promise from the last electoral term? No matter what he tells us, you cannot reform the European Union because all 27 member states will have to agree. It's just impossible to do. The only real way for the United Kingdom to go forward is to actually have a referendum, get our people to vote to leave the European Union, and you would have to have a phased withdrawal. But within 5-6 years, you would find that the United Kingdom would be much better off. You know, we hear the fear-mongering here from people, trade, we'll not be able to trade. We've got a £100 billion deficit with the European Union. Do you honestly think that if we leave, they won't let us trade with them? Of course they will. They're going to want to sell their BMWs, their Mercedes, their Bosch, their Siemens, all into the United Kingdom. There still will be a free trade zone. Trade will not be affected. But what will be taken off us is the huge burdens that they put on us. In terms of religion, and the way that the European Union behaves towards religion, it is a really curious place. I'm a Christian, and whenever I walked into that building, the hair stood on the back of my neck. And I seen this poster, and this poster had a depiction of the Tower of Babel being rebuilt by a crane, and it showed all the different voices working together, all these different people being brought together to rebuild this Tower of Babel. And the actual European Union building in Strasbourg is based on the depiction of the Tower of Babel. Well, to me, any organisation that thinks it's greater than the power of God is in for a shot. And I just want to get out of it. I want to get our people out and get away from Europe. But I'm quite clear that it's not possible to reform the European Union. We can leave it. We can trade with them. We can be really good friends with them. But do we want to be part
okay,
of
thanks,
Europe
Henry.
That yesterday elected Jobbik? 20% of the people in Hungary voted for Jobbik. Golden Dawn in Greece. Europe is creating monsters right across Europe. Jobbik wants every Jew in Europe killed or driven off the continent of Europe. Is that the sort of people that we want to work with in Europe? No, it's not. We want our own British democracy where the people that you vote for make your laws. And that's the way the country has been for 300 years now. That's the way it should be in the future.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you.
Erwin Armstrong.
I think when we talk about reforming Europe, we have to look at what it actually does. And it actually controls, I think, something like 80% of the laws enacted in the United Kingdom at the moment. It sets our health and safety regulations. And I'm sure you've all heard horror stories from those. But that doesn't mean the option is to leave the European Union. The option, and I don't agree with Henry at all here, is that there are many of the larger countries within the European Union who actually do want to reform it. They want it to be something that I voted for back in a long time ago, 1975, I think it was, and some of you may have voted for it as well, to join the European Economic Community. And the vote at that stage was to open the markets to us, and I think they had rejected us a couple of times before that, so maybe they didn't really want us at all. But as I said earlier, I trade across Europe, and it is better for us to be together, but I think the phrase that has been oft used, you know, it's in Europe but not run by Europe, is where we need to get to. And I would all be for repatriation of powers from Europe back to the United Kingdom, where it frees up. It takes away the red tape. It takes away the right to 20 weeks off if you're pregnant and all of those things. Small companies can't afford that. It's okay if you're a multinational, but smaller companies cannot afford all of these things.
if we are going to succeed. We cannot stop companies growing by regulation, and that really is what is happening in Europe. So those are the things we need to do to change it. I want a referendum. I want to look very carefully at what happens to the negotiations between now and then. And I want people, as I said earlier, to have the opportunity, not where politicians can tell people or ignore them or not want them to have a say. I want everybody here tonight to actually be able to go out and vote and say, I want to be in or I want to be out, okay. But not based on some notion of what Europe is about, but based on what it actually is and what it actually does mean to the country. And I think I am very much of a mind that we can actually renegotiate in Europe. And Angela Merkel is coming to that. And when Angela Merkel decides in Europe, then other people pay attention. So I think over the next couple of years, we will see that happening and we'll see that moving forward. Okay. Then you
Thanks.
Can all vote in the way that you want to, not the politicians. Thanks.
Right. Ross Brown on that specific issue, forgive me.
Okay, I think there's a number of things that we would like to see changed in Europe, and the first one is for Europe to become more legitimate in terms of how it's set up democratically. We would like to see, for example, the European Parliament have more power over the other institutions, because at the moment we have non-democratically elected commissioners, for example, initiating all of the European rules. And I think that the European Parliament, the democratically elected aspect of Europe, should certainly become more more powerful in that respect. We would also like to see, in terms of social aspect of Europe, I mean, social standards applied across the board in terms of minimum social standards and even a social passport that allows you to travel, where you don't have this situation where people are they're afraid that people are moving for various welfare benefits, which I don't think is actually the case. And I think very, very importantly, the whole question of transparency in politics and clean politics. 30 billion euros every year is spent by lobbying firms. 90% of them are large corporations every year in Brussels. And at the moment, there's no register of interests about who is being lobbied and what they're actually doing. And bringing
Ross, would you support a single European state? I mean, just to understand, do you think that would be a good idea, for instance, you talk about increasing the powers of the European Parliament? I'm not being pejorative. Do you think a single European state, that there's an argument for that?
No, what I'm saying here, I'm not making the case for a single European state. What I'm saying is that we currently have a number of institutions in Brussels. We've got the European Commission, which the commissioners are appointed by governments, and we also have the Council of Ministers, which is made up from ministers representing Sure. the state governments. Now, the Council of Ministers has the same power at the moment as the European Parliament, and the democratically elected part of Europe is the European Parliament, and that is what should be driving the agenda in Europe, because that is the most democratic and the most legitimate voice of all the European citizens. So I think Europe needs to become more democratic in that respect,
right.
More directly democratic to represent the interests of the people.
Thanks. Okay, Reg, MP, how would you encourage first-time voters, a few of whom are here tonight?
Well, as I referred to earlier, the chances are first-time voters are going to be young people, so therefore the facts that we saw earlier this week were very disturbing. Not a huge surprise to some of us, I guess, but the one thing I would make clear, if you're not in, you can't win. So if people don't participate when they have the right to participate, and was it last year we were celebrating the suffragettes and the groundbreaking work that they had done to get the vote, so many people don't vote at all. In fact, in Great Britain, I think it'll be maybe 20% if it's even that. As I said in my opening remarks, Europe is important for a whole variety of reasons, and it's the next generation we have to try and make a better foundation for them than we've done ourselves. So I would encourage them, because it is their future and it is up to them to participate, and I would encourage them to participate. They have the vote if they're on the register. They should exercise that vote, because if they stay away, then it's the people very often who stay away determine who gets elected. So it's vitally important that our young people participate. Anybody looking at those surveys cannot be but shocked at the disillusionment and the fact that they're so turned off. And we've done a bad job if we leave the younger generation so disillusioned that they're not even prepared to walk a few yards to a polling station. So I would encourage them, I plead with them, to participate, because that's the only way they can really bring their influence to bear and get the policies that they want for their future.
Thanks. Gavin Robinson.
Thank you. I don't disagree with Reg at all. And in fact, in answering a question like this, I think it's important that rather than be party political, I think it's important to encourage people to get involved in the political class. You'll hear many different versions of what people believe about Europe this evening. You'll hear about how people think it should be reformed or how it's great. The fact is, if you learn anything or take anything away from this evening, is that it has a huge impact on your day-to-day life. You may describe it positively or you may describe it negatively, but it has a huge impact on your day-to-day life. And if you're not in it, you can't complain about it. If you don't find somebody who represents your views and you don't have your say, then your ability to complain, to indicate that you think the political class isn't doing what you expect of it, is greatly diminished. So I would encourage people to vote. I think there are many great reasons to be involved in politics and great reasons to be enthusiastic about having your say, whether it's in your local community here in East Belfast, whether it's at an assembly level, at a Westminster level, or even a European level as well. It may feel remote. You may not feel a day-to-day impact in how you live your lives, although I argue you should. But unless you have your say, it's incredibly difficult to complain when you don't think things are going the right way.
Alex,
that's why I think it's important.
Well, I think I tried to touch upon that very issue in my opening remarks. I think if we step back from the to-ings and fro-ings and the insults and the hurts of our recent politics, I think people in this hall, in this church, and in the 50 days of canvassing that I've had and 220 meetings with people and groups and individuals and families and citizens and chambers of trade, I think there's a growing sense that this election, beyond who you vote for, going to Europe or going into councils, that this election is about defining in a fundamental and positive and powerful way how we're going to go forward given the failures of where we are. I think that's, and that it's young people have the sense of that more than any others, because it's young people have the appetite for adventure over the love of ease. They're not my words. They're the words of the late Robert Kennedy, who's a big influence upon my thinking. That it is young people, not a lot of people in this hall, in this church, but young people have the sense that the hope and ambition, idealism, that once informed our politics after ceasefires and Good Friday agreements, that that's somehow been squandered. And I think there's this growing sense among young people and those who think like young people, who can be of many generations, that this is the moment when we have to pivot, to use the word of Richard Haass, and shape our ambition and our politics in the image of something different. And when it comes to Europe, I think young people, perhaps more than our generations, young people have a better understanding of what it is to be internationalist and to be European. I think they have an understanding of what the European Union is in an intuitive and emotional way that we don't. And that I think they understand better than we do the threats to our society and our lives, never mind our economy, by not being part of the European Union. And when you put all that together, I actually think that this is the moment to regain the idealism and the optimism of the past and not see the degradation of our politics deepen and endure in May of this year and in the Mays of the next 2 years.
Thank you. I'm going to slightly change this question, because I'm going to ask Martina Anderson. The question asks, how would your election help to overcome the disastrous community divisions within Northern Ireland? And maybe, Martina, I could ask you, tell us about, you've been in Europe for the last 5 years. Tell us about what cooperation there was and there should be between the representatives from Northern Ireland.
Well, I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to address that question, because there were some comments made by some of the speakers that we don't work collectively together. And we do. I work with all 15 Irish MEPs. The three Irish MEPs from here, we have worked on a number of issues. State aid, a number of other issues that have been collectively brought to our attention. I have taken over groups and organisations, and I have invited both Diane and Jim to all of those meetings to engage with groups, whether it's the GAA, rugby, the Chambers of Commerce. I took Chambers of Commerce from across the north, from Larne, from North Belfast, from all over the six counties. I didn't take them from one tradition or another. And that's the way that we work. We also have delegations coming over from us, departments come over, ministers come over, and we meet them, for instance, the three MEPs here, but for myself, during the Irish presidency, I engaged with all 15 MEPs so that the needs for the North and the agreements that were being made during the Irish presidency, that there was representation in that room from an MEP from here.
Okay, thank you very much. Anna Lou. How would you overcome our disastrous divisions within Europe if you were elected?
How would I overcome
How would you help or contribute to overcoming the divisions that we have in Northern Ireland in Europe? How would you see that happening in Europe?
Well,
does it provide a broader framework?
Sure, absolutely. I think on many fronts, I think Europe has helped to break down barriers between peoples, between nations and governments. I think being in Europe would help us to widen our perspective, look wider than our own problems. I think that's very important. And I would like to see Europe helping us to improve our community relations. We are seeing now Peace 4 coming, and if I were in Europe, I think I would work very hard to try to bring more money into helping us to do more reconciliation work and bringing more young people together. And young people are our future. We are very much here stuck in old politics. We need more young people not just to come out to vote, but also to participate in politics, to bring in a new, fresh face of politics into Northern Ireland that's working for everyone. In terms of the environment, I think no one has mentioned environment, and not even the Green tonight has mentioned environment.
I know he's anxious to get in.
Okay. Well, certainly, I mean, Europe has been leading in climate change adaptation and renewable energy. I think they, being part of Europe would help us also to help us looking at energy consumption and developing our potentials for renewable energy. In Northern Ireland, we have huge potentials for, as we all know, lots of wind and lots of waters around us. So, I mean, developing wind energy, developing tidal waves energy, I mean, that working in Europe would help us. And also a single market in energy would be a wonderful idea. We can contribute into it, but with the economy of scale, we certainly would get a lot cheaper fuel prices, and we'll move away from fossil fuel, and because gas and oil are running out, and we are going to see certainly energy prices going up and up
in the next 50 years. Ross would endorse those comments very strongly, and I'm sure that's taken as read, Ross. Can I just say briefly, as a brief interlude, one of the things that I found interesting in the area which we were brought to very kindly for a cup of tea before this evening was the cordiality between all of the various contributors. And I think sometimes we miss out on that. We do not see the kind of genuine human warmth that there is between candidates. I think that's important because I mentioned at the outset, we need to learn in Northern Ireland how to disagree well. We haven't always been very good at it. And with that tone set, I'm going to shift slightly from the questions that I have been given here, and just briefly to open it up to the floor with one caveat, that we refer and we retain the European focus. There are many questions that I've received which would do very well in Belfast City Council of a Monday evening, but we already have a forum for that particular debate, and I'm sure you all know what it's about. So can we focus on Europe? And with that in mind, and the disagreeing well at the heart of our concern, can you ask the questions? If you ask the questions, I will then field it to a particular candidate.
A question is for Martina Anderson. The last time I was in this church, Martina, was to bury my best friend at school. He was on his way to Daisy Hill Hospital in 1979. Three of his colleagues in the REC were blown to smithereens. Have you any words for the fiancé who was to be married in a few weeks' time, just after when he was blew to pieces? Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think in the first instance, I would like to say that I'm very sorry to hear about that loss. I think that we could sit here and probably the two of us exchange incidents of tragedies, what happened in the north, and I could talk to you about Bloody Sunday. I could talk to you about my brother-in-law when my husband was a 15-year-old child and his brother was shot by the RUC on a shoot to kill. I don't think that you and I exchange in those kind of views with one another would probably take our discussion very far. We have come through a terrible conflict and we hurt each other. And we have a lot to do to try to heal the hurt and pain that's in our society across the two traditions. I think that the leadership shown from Martin McGuinness this evening, who went to meet with Queen Elizabeth, and I also think that the leadership shown by Queen Elizabeth in wanting to meet Martin McGuinness, is what I am hoping will give our young people some hope and encouragement. What we need to do is build upon the kind of reconciliation. So what happened in our past, to your friends, to my friends, to people we loved deeply, will never be visited on this community ever again. And I deliberately say community and not communities, because we have got different traditions, but I believe we are one community of people. And it's going to be very difficult as we go through this journey, but it takes courage to compromise. And compromise is inherent in the process of change that we are involved in. And that's what we need to do in the time ahead.
Thank you, Martina.
And I hope you do too.
Yes, thank you. No, any further questions? John.
Hi there. Just referring back to what Lord MP was saying about turnout and about encouraging young people to vote, what would the panel suggest? This is an electoral system which, in theory, is supposed to encourage the widest possible participation. Yet, probably one of the headlines on the 23rd of May will be 35, 40% people voting, 60% of those theoretically who could vote not voting. Are there any ways you can think of that you might suggest in the future for enhancing participation, changing the day of the election, changing the means of election? How do you get more people to actually participate and, as Ross talks about, legitimising the system? Because it doesn't look terribly legitimate when 70% of people don't vote.
Tina McKenzie.
I think the interesting thing about Northern Ireland, and indeed our young people, is that they're not interested in politics. You go anywhere and speak to anyone, we've all got an opinion. We're very opinionated in Northern Ireland, that's for sure. The difficulty is that they do not feel they're either empowered or that they can relate to what we have at Stormont. We have, and if the gentlemen on the stage will forgive me, we have a lot of grey-haired gentlemen in Stormont. The average age, I believe, is 58, 59. We're even struggling to get women involved. We have one of the lowest percentages of women in politics only beaten by the Republic of Ireland, but they've just introduced a new quota system to overcome that. So we have a real problem in Northern Ireland, and our difficulty is that as more and more people separate themselves from the political establishment because they're not happy about what they see, the more and more we'll see the extremes take over. So our call, NI21's call, if I may talk about a party, our call is to all people in Northern Ireland, is to say, get involved, come out and vote, especially, and I see young people in the audience tonight, I don't care who you vote for. Well, yes, I'd like you to vote for me, of course, and our local councillors. But if, as long as we get the amount of people coming to vote up higher, then we will get a better result, and the less extreme politics in Northern Ireland, that will have a domino effect on the amount of people that want to be associated with these politicians, because that's part of the problem. People are just moving further away from the politicians, but certainly not the issues, not the politics.
Okay. Thanks, Tina. All right. There's a number of cases there. The gentleman at the back, and then this gentleman here.
This is a single transferable vote election. Will the members of the panel be using their number 2 and 3?
Very good question.
And who to?
Yes, Gavin Robinson.
Sorry, Brett, you won't have the opportunity of using your transfer for me in this election unless you live in my council area.
Yeah.
So you can't unless you're just asking me to answer this question. I think the original question...
How would you answer if you were Dan Dodds?
But I think it would be... to transfer, from my perspective, to other like-minded unionists. And I think the original question, not David's supplementary, the original question from John, I think it was, talked about how low expected turnout will be. What you'll find is you'll have a greater turnout in Northern Ireland still than you will in England and Wales, less than what it has been over the course of the last 15 years, because the issues... aren't as accentuated.
Could I ask you, Gavin, could I ask you this?
Yeah.
Do you think that it is appropriate, because one of the things that you have in a single transferable vote system is the ability to influence the debate on the other side, if you use your vote properly. Do you think that unionists should use their vote right down to the last number? Because that's how PR works if it's working properly. There seems to be a perception... certainly in some communities, that you shouldn't do that. What's your view of that?
Well, there's two views on it. One is absolutely use your vote the whole way down. And if you have a transfer to be made from your first candidate, then great, you will have your say further down the list. You may include people who otherwise wouldn't have been included. You may also exclude those people that you wish to exclude. The other side of that is some people have a difficulty endorsing a candidate that they don't support. I can tell you I'll be voting Diane Dodds number one. I will be looking favourably upon other unionists who share our outlook on Europe and also at the council elections as well.
Will you stop there?
Transfer. I have to say that having gone through numerous election counts, the value becomes greatly diminished. And in fact, if you have a candidate who manages to get above quota, then you take the surplus above the quota and that gets distributed on a proportional or percentage basis. So actually, you can talk about a minimal return from the transfer. What I will do, I mean, I will not personally vote for a candidate that I do not support. So in that sense, I'll not use it as tactically as you might suggest others do. But I encourage people to use their vote, to vote with your conscience, vote with your heart. And if you support your candidate number one and you feel able to move to number two, then do that. Because there are three candidates elected, you should at the very least have a say in those three.
This is an interesting question. Alex Atwood, using your vote in a PR election.
Well, first of all, can I say that the SDLP... will only have one electoral strategy come 22nd of May.
To vote the SDLP.
Is to vote the SDLP.
Understand.
And we will not be given advice after that. We will reject any electoral pacts with any party. Mm-hmm. We will not reduce this election to poking the other side in the face. And that's the danger about the current talk about electoral pacts. And the reason why we will stick unambiguously to that approach is that this election can be about strength again in Europe, and it can again be about reshaping our politics in a positive way. And if any party, and the SDLP included, gets into the practice of saying who you should vote 2, 3, and 4, then you will take away from that big message.
Can I ask you this? Would you encourage people to use their vote completely, or are you agnostic on who else gets elected?
And I believe in the sovereignty of the individual. And the sovereignty of the individual is that they should vote as they think their judgment and conscience allows them to, as far down the ballot paper as they may wish to go. And that's the advice. And anything further than that brings our politics back to the politics of the past, when this election can be about the future. The question that was asked earlier about how can you help people vote, I can answer that in the technical way. Use social media, use Facebook, have voting at the weekends, reduce the age of voting. But the real truth is this. In July and August of last year, everybody said, or not everybody, but some people said, that when it came to Haas, it couldn't deal with the past. Yet when it came to New Year's Eve, Richard Haas said that the biggest issue that he had been trying to deal with, and he had dealt with even though some didn't agree with it, was the past. And why? Because the victims and survivors, the people that you were talking about earlier, they gathered themselves, they informed the politics, they informed the mind of Haas and O'Sullivan, and on the far side of that, despite Haas believing that you couldn't deal with the past in a comprehensive and ethical way, their will and their wisdom prevailed. And I think that's out there again when it comes to the European and Council election, that people are wiser than what passes for politics in the media and up in Stormont at the moment.
Okay. Reg MP, I'm going to keep with this a little while because I think particularly young people are interested in a PR election. They're interested in how to use your vote. And I know that politicians have to say, well, just vote for me and really whatever else is up to anybody else. But I think people will want to know, you know, how do you use your vote? Is it better to have a least worst option? Is it better to, are you allowed to express a view on whether you prefer one brand of nationalist as opposed to another brand of nationalist or vice versa? How do you see, apart from voting Ulster Unionist, Reg, to encourage people to use an STV system? It seems to me an awful lot of people in Northern Ireland don't understand PR completely.
It is very complicated, and people have lost seats by one third of a vote.
Yes.
And if you try and explain that to English people, they just freeze over. In certain circumstances, I can see a case for using the proportional representation system so that you influence the vote on a basis from your preference, your first preference down. And it can be, and I can only speak personally, because I haven't talked to Jim about this, but in a personal sense, I would look at the opportunity to influence further down the ballot.
Yes.
Because in certain circumstances, that can actually play a major part.
Yes.
And that is the whole rationale for having proportional representation. You go. It's a question of preference. You could have 15, 20 names on a paper. Yeah. So each of those preferences, yes, they get smaller in value, but you can still influence.
Yes.
And that is the point of having it.
Thank you. This gentleman here.
We were talking about democracy earlier, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on an institution that can near enough forcibly remove two governments in Greece and Italy, wanting to do similar to Spain and Portugal. Yeah. Group countries as pigs, as in Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece and Spain, and the ultimate insult of finding the Irish budget in the Bundestag before the TD's seen it. What is the, what more insults can we take from this institution?
Erwin Armstrong.
I think we have to look at the circumstances for all of these things. And I know the Irish budget was very difficult because Ireland at that stage was very close to being a bankrupt state. And it needed money very quickly. And the only place it was coming from, I think, really was the European Union. And I know the UK did contribute something to it. So when you're in a very difficult position, you know, it's a bit like if you're a business going to talk to your bank manager, you have to listen to what he has to say. If you need more money, you cannot say to him, you're going to give me money or do anything. It is all about listening to what he's telling you you need to do. And I think in those circumstances, the politicians got themselves into a problem and they had to get themselves out of a problem, and the only way they could do it really was going cap in hand to sort it out. Thankfully, that has now managed to sort itself out. But if you join the European Union and you join the Euro, these are the sort of problems you're getting yourself into, because we all know that there were many countries like Greece
who should never have been allowed into the European Union because their economies were fiddled to get them in. So the price the politicians paid was the price for telling lies and manipulating figures to get into the to the euro. So I don't think you can blame the European Union for looking askance at what they were doing.
Thanks, Herman. I suspect, Henry, that you would not support us joining the euro, but I know you want to talk on this particular subject. So if you get, if you want to have 2 minutes. On the
I think this man's made some very, very pertinent points.
Yes.
That here we have this European bureaucracy that's controlled by 27 unelected people who meet in secret. They devised a single currency that was never going to work. And it's curious that there are some people sitting in this panel who thought it was brilliant, who thought that the United Kingdom was going to sink beneath the Atlantic Ocean if we didn't join the single currency. The same people who tell us, oh, we have to stay in Europe to trade. This is the same scare tactics these people use. Goldman Sachs has more power across Europe than any of our elected representatives. Look who's the stooge man in Italy, in Spain, in Greece. The Irish Republic, I know many politicians who operate down there, and they would tell you that they live through a humiliation. At the present time, the Republic of Ireland has been economically raped. Their water industry, everything, is, all their utilities are now being privatised under the direction of this European hand. Go to Greece, exactly the same thing's happened. All their utilities privatised, sucking everything of value out and putting nothing back in. The Greeks, the Spanish, the Portuguese and the Republic of Ireland would have been far, far better to stay outside the European Union. They still would have had functional democracies. What we have in the Republic is not a true democracy now. It's bad enough here because we're still subservient to Europe. But what's happening in the Republic of Ireland is quite incredible.
Okay, thanks. There's a lady at the back. Yes. We're coming to the end, so I think we've...
My question is primarily aimed at Anna Lou, but the rest of the panellists can give an option as well. I was just wondering if she agreed with the current Executive Minister, Stephen Fry, when he said that the Alliance supports the UK's entry into this European single currency at the earliest possible opportunity. Does she agree with that statement?
Well, I think at the moment, Sunny, the Eurozone and the Euro is not that favourable for us to join, and I think maybe we may have to see how things go before we would want to, I think, to join the Eurozone. I think we are better off to be staying, you know, within the UK and you know, using our own pounds and sterlings. But certainly, Stephen Fary has done an awful lot and actually got a lot of money out of EU for research and development in Northern Ireland, and also about promoting apprenticeship. He recently just published a strategy on promoting apprenticeship really on the wide range, and certainly Europe would help. And it is not just about, you know, the low jobs that traditionally you think about apprenticeship would be. Now, you know, we're looking at really high-level skill, NVQ 4, 5 grades. So, I mean, that's another route for our young people, that they don't have to go to university, but they can have apprenticeship.
Okay.
And, you know, apprenticeship in Europe is very well developed in our young people, and we can certainly look across and learn lessons from them.
Okay, thank you very much, Anna. I know that there was other questions. We're moving on. Time is beating us.